Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of Deckard and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. President Trump's expected to create a $1.7 billion slush fund to help friends who claim they were targeted by the Biden administration. Gene Rossi comes to us with nearly three decades of criminal and civil litigation experience at the U.S. Department of Justice, primarily focusing on criminal defense and government investigations. He's a shareholder in the firm of Carlton Fields. He's worked in various roles at George Mason, Harvard, University of Virginia, American University, grew up on a dairy farm in the Northeast, worked at his family's lumber business. So quite a path to get to this point here on Legal Face-Off. Gene Rossi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're calling it a slush fund. Trump calls it an anti-weaponization compensation fund. We're talking in a moment to Richard Painter about the IRS part of it. But let's focus on this fund. You're a former federal prosecutor. What is the legal authority? I know that's a old-fashioned term, right? Legal authority. But what legal authority is the Trump administration relying on to create this fund for these alleged government weaponization victims?
All right, I got to stress, this is not a strong argument. I'm trying to put myself in their shoes at the Department of Justice, which has its issues, and that's an understatement. But if I were Todd Blanche or the people around him, I would say that this is not unprecedented, that even under Obama, they set up a fund for, I think it was Native Americans who were harmed by certain actions of the government, and that they worked out a settlement, and that the victims, alleged victims in that case, the Native Americans or the victims in that trust fund, that they were able to apply to the fund. And that was approved by the Attorney General under Obama. And this is just a precedent for what they're doing now. That's their argument.
Okay, so I want to ask you a follow-up to that before Tina jumps in. So because a lot of the criticism against this fund has been based on the idea that only Congress can appropriate funds for the government, that this is the executive branch stepping in and appropriating funds. You're saying that that's not quite true, that there is a precedent for establishing a fund of money to compensate victims by the executive branch, right?
Yes. I'll give you a good example. Congress has appropriated money to the Department of Justice. I think it's discretionary that they can set up settlement funds. I and about 500 other people, there was a toxic waste dump run by the government. And, I'm somebody who lived on the river and I got cancer or had complications. I sued a government and they set up a fund for the victims of the alleged waste. And I think Congress has allowed the Department of Justice to set up a fund to address those victims. But that's the argument they make. That's the argument they make. And I said it's weak. When you go behind the curtain, it's a lot different than what Obama and other attorney generals have done.
So, Gene, from your experience inside the Justice Department, how difficult would it be to legally distinguish between actual prosecutorial misconduct and just simply unpopular investigations?
There are two concepts. When I was a federal prosecutor, two concepts that I was very afraid of, a vindictive prosecution arguments and selective prosecution arguments. The Supreme Court law on both is very hard for a complainant, a plaintiff. Selective prosecution is very straightforward. Tina, you and I go to Wolf Trap. It's a place where they have concerts outside of D.C., And the park police, I'm making this all up, park police arrest 100 people. and they only prosecute people with a vowel at the end of their name, Martini and Rossi. You thought I could sneak it in, all right? The other 98, Tina, are let go. That's selective prosecution if we had the same problem. You know, we had an open container, or we were allegedly smoking marijuana or illicit drugs. That's selective. Vindictive is the government focuses on an individual because of their political beliefs. It could be their race. It could be their gender. It could be a host of other things. And they focus just on that person. That's the classic Jim Comey. They're focusing on him. That's vindictive. So what's the fine line? The fine line is you want career prosecutors, not political hacks or political sycophants, running these investigations. And I'll give you a good example. My synagogue, my church, my mosque was the Eastern District of Virginia, where I worked there 20 years and as an assistant U.S. attorney. When Donald Trump put in Lindsey Halligan as the acting attorney general, U.S. attorney or interim, that defiled that office because all these major cases were handled by career people, not somebody with no experience other than handling a few insurance claims. So vindictive and selective, it's a fine line, but you never come close to that, Tina. If you do your job and apply the law to the facts as you see them and not do what they're doing now, which is just looking at the individual saying, find me the person, I will find a crime. And that's wrong.
Shane, you can't look at this without considering January 6th, obviously been the subject of lots of discussions since this ridiculous deal came to light. And when you consider that Trump pardoned on his first day in office, all the January 6th, protesters, rioters, conspirators.
Including one of my clients.
Okay, well, there you go. They are also allowed, I mean, any American, as Todd Blanchett, even you know, Hunter Biden, I guess, could apply for this money. But what are your feelings on that? That January 6th conspirators, people who attack police officers, people who attack the Capitol, can now be compensated for what they went through.
I have a lot of thoughts on this. I had a 6-week trial. I'm not going to mention my client's name, but he was a young kid, 21 years old. He had autism, ASD. And he was one of five defendants who were prosecuted in a 6-week trial. He was convicted. Okay, he was the first oath keeper in the Capitol, entered the East Side. He didn't hurt a police officer. In my view, all he did was go in, yell and scream. You know, the fight's not over. You know, the election's rigged, or words to that effect. He trespassed. He committed misdemeanors, maybe a disorderly conduct. But that individual is different than the 200 or 300 that engaged in violence, almost killed 2 police officers, maybe 5, were there to kill Pelosi or kidnap her. Those 200 or 300 people, they should never, ever, ever even apply to this fund, let alone get any money. My client, he was put through heck. H-E double hockey sticks. And you know, I got to say that prosecution, and I'm not a Trumpster, believe me, that prosecution was a little too aggressive for my taste. But I if he ever got money, I wouldn't be offended by that. But the 200 or 300 that were engaged in violence and intended to commit violence, not my client, those individuals, it's a disgrace.
So, Gene, what precedent do you think is most worrisome if the federal government starts financially compensating people who claim they were unfairly investigated or prosecuted?
The precedent that will be set if money's going out from this fund to the individuals that we think will apply is that you can be a criminal, you can be convicted by a jury of your peers. And after you serve your sentence, or before you serve your sentence, you may get compensated for your attorney's fees. There already is a vehicle in criminal cases, and I had to settle one when I was a prosecutor. If you are indicted or charged and you are acquitted, or if there's a hung jury, or there's a Rule 29, a dismissal of your charges before the jury gets it, or even after, a criminal defendant can get their legal fees paid for if the prosecution is in bad faith. That gets to vindictive or selective, and or it's frivolous. So there is a vehicle already. You don't need a fund. There is a vehicle already for people who beat their charges, but there is no fund ever, except this one, where somebody who's convicted, they've exhausted their appeals, and then they get money at the end. That should never happen. That should never happen.
I think we need more Martini and Rossi on Legal Face Off. Gene Rossi, thanks for coming on. I really hope we can speak again in the future.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to Legal Face-Off at WGNRadio.com. Well, President Trump reached an agreement with the DOJ, ending any current audits of him, his family, or his business. Remember, he sued the IRS for $10 billion back in January. Let's dig a little deeper into this. Richard Painter is a professor of corporate law at University of Minnesota. Before that, he clerked at the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, practiced law in New York and Connecticut, was a faculty member at University of Oregon, University of Illinois. He likes working at those Big Ten schools, apparently, at least what is now the Big Ten schools. Thank you so much, Professor, for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Professor, last week, President Donald Trump and the IRS reached a settlement of the $10 billion lawsuit that he filed regarding the tax information that was leaked to the New York Times. Tell us a little bit more about this settlement.
Well, first, I think it should be very clear the IRS should not release anyone's tax return, and a rogue IRS employee did release his tax return and should not have done that. And maybe he's entitled to some damages because of that, although I haven't seen other cases in which people have received significant damages from the IRS because a rogue employee released their tax return. But the amount he sought was astronomical, way out of line with whatever damages he might be entitled to because of the release of his tax return. And for him to settle out all of his other IRS claims as part of this, or the IRS claims against him, could very well be a violation of the United States Constitution. The Domestic Emoluments Clause of the Constitution specifically provides that the president shall not receive from the United States government or from any of the states compensation in excess of the compensation appropriated to him by Congress. And the word used in that clause is emolument. The president shall not receive an emolument from the federal government or from the states in excess of the salary appropriated by Congress. An emolument is a profit or advantage as defined in the dictionaries at the time of the adoption of our Constitution. The founders anticipated the problem that a president could try to put his hand into the treasury and receive a benefit, a profit, an emolument from the treasury by way of either a cash payment or forgiveness of any money owed to the treasury by the president. And that is specifically unconstitutional. Bottom line is President Trump is not entitled to a settlement with the IRS that another taxpayer would not get. And if he does get a settlement with the IRS that another taxpayer would not get, a subsequent administration could seek to unwind that settlement, saying that it is unconstitutional under the Domestic Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. So if he does owe taxes, and the Trump Organization does owe taxes, if they do, and I don't see the proof one way or the other, but if they do, and those taxes owed are forgiven as part of the settlement, and it's in excess of what a taxpayer would ordinarily be entitled to when someone released their tax returns illegally, then that money could be clawed back as a violation of the United States Constitution.
Let's take a deeper dive into what particular parts of the Constitution are being violated here, because part of the settlement is that the IRS is now prevented. It's hard to even get these words out. It's so shocking. And like, normally this would be the biggest story ever. But it prevents the IRS from reviewing or auditing his past tax returns, not just Trump, but his family and other related business entities. How is that possible? How does he get a deal that he's never going to be audited again for past or prior alleged tax violations? And I mean, doesn't this just open up the door for anyone in the family and his business to not pay taxes? What would be the repercussion if they didn't pay taxes? Nothing, if this settlement goes through.
Well, that's precisely the problem. The President of the United States can fire the Treasury Secretary, the IRS Commissioner. They work as part of the executive branch. It can be removed at will by the President. And so now we see the Treasury Department settling a case with Donald Trump, taxpayer, to enormous advantage of Donald Trump. The problem here is that this is exactly what the framers anticipated when they drafted the Domestic Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, saying that the president shall not receive any emolument from the United States government in excess of the salary appropriated to the president by Congress. An emolument is a profit or advantage. Read the definition in Dr. Samuel Johnson's 1755 dictionary. That's the operative dictionary of the English language at the time. That's what an emolument is. It's certainly a profit or advantage. It's one I would love to have from the IRS, where they say, well, we'll never audit any of your returns. Maybe you never have to pay taxes. Every American would like that profit or advantage. But the bottom line is that emolument, that profit advantage, is unconstitutional if received by the President of the United States. And that's why I believe that a subsequent administration could seek to unwind the deal.
So, Professor, we understand what you're saying about the Emoluments Clause. There are a couple of different potential causes of action or avenues that have been written about since this decision came down with respect to potentially challenging this settlement. One aspect is the power that's given to the heads of the congressional tax committees to allow them to examine anyone's returns. What do you think is the impact of this settlement on that power?
Well, I think the members of the committees in Congress may seek to examine the returns pursuant to whatever legal authority they have. At this point, I don't think the majority in the House or Senate wants to do that, because no one in the Republican Party is willing to challenge Donald Trump. Now, maybe the House or the Senate changes hands and a committee chair wants to examine the returns. And there, of course, will be a battle then between Congress and the Treasury as to whether they get to see the returns and find out what's going on here. We'll see what happens. But it is also true that a subsequent Treasury Department, under a subsequent president, could say that this is not a valid settlement and could seek to unwind the deal and go in front of a court and say this is an unconstitutional emolument, and that the Treasury Department that reached this settlement with Donald Trump was a Treasury Department controlled by Donald Trump. I mean, we would all like to be the boss of the IRS and tell the IRS what to do, not to make us pay taxes. I mean, I'm sure everyone would like that, but that's not the way it works. And this is the fundamental problem that the founders anticipated when they drafted the Domestic Emoluments Clause. So bottom line, we can have some challenge from Congress and for the, over the next 2 years, but we may very well find that a subsequent administration of the IRS really decides to push back on this if the IRS really does believe that Donald Trump owes taxes. And I want to emphasize that I do not know one way or the other whether he owes taxes. Maybe he's paid too much by way of taxes. I have no idea.
What about the idea that this was a document, a one-page document, Professor, that was signed by the acting Attorney General, Todd Blanche, who, of course, is former Trump personal lawyer, where he wrote these words that, you know, just to show the chutzpah, for lack of a better term, in capital letters, that the family would be forever barred and precluded from prosecuting or being pursued by tax claims. Does the fact that, you know, it's clearly a conflict of interest for Blanche to do this, does that bother you as well? Or
that is a serious concern. So even if it weren't the president of the United States who's subject to the domestic emoluments clause, let's say it's the Treasury Secretary who entered into this deal, but the Treasury Secretary, of course, supervises the IRS, or maybe the Attorney General or some other powerful public official who entered into this deal with their former personal lawyer, then representing the Justice Department, I could easily see a suit to unwind the deal as self-dealing, as unconscionable on basic conflict of interest and legal ethics grounds. The Attorney General of the United States is the Chief Law Enforcement Officer of the United States and has only one client, the United States of America, not the President of the United States in his personal capacity or anyone else. And so if the Attorney General is simply cutting a deal with his former client in his personal capacity, Donald Trump, while representing the United States government, there could very well be a fundamental conflict of interest for the Attorney General, for the acting Attorney General, in this situation, that also could lead to a future administration challenging the transaction in court.
Okay, so speaking of court, our last question here is, how the Supreme Court might handle this unprecedented move. We know that there is a solid 6-3 conservative majority. There's a couple of votes in the middle, perhaps, of that 6-3 that could go either way, that have gone either way, that have not necessarily followed the president and some of his more controversial actions. How do you foresee the Supreme Court dealing with this issue?
Well, the big hurdle is standing. And I ran into that when we sued the President of the United States over the violation of the Foreign Emoluments Clause, which prohibits receipt of any emolument from a foreign government. And the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington filed that lawsuit when I was vice chair of the organization in 2017. And the courts held that we didn't have standing. Only companies competing with Donald Trump's businesses have standing, which is somewhat strange because that's not why the founders drafted the Foreign Emoluments Clause at all. So standing's a big problem and will be, except for, I know one thing, is the IRS does have standing. And so if the IRS in a later administration chooses to challenge this deal, then that is an issue that would squarely be presented in front of the Supreme Court of the United States. And I don't see more conservative justices of wanting to bend over backwards to find in favor of a former president who's never going to be president again on this issue, in effect saying the President of the United States can put his hand into the Federal Treasury anytime he wants. If Donald Trump owes taxes, I believe that he's going to end up having to pay those taxes. If the Trump Organization owes taxes, if the family owes taxes, then ultimately they're going to have to pay those taxes. And I would be very surprised to see the Supreme Court uphold a deal such as this that appears to me to be a clear violation of the Domestic Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. But I don't know what the court will do, and I would not expect any positive developments in the courts until there's a new administration that is willing to assert, in this case, and make a claim on behalf of the IRS.
And speaking of the $10 billion lawsuits that kind of started this all, President Trump just refiled a $10 billion lawsuit against the Wall Street Journal over reports tying him to Jeffrey Epstein. So stay tuned for that. I'm sure we'll talk about it more, maybe with Professor Richard Painter, who's a repeat guest for us. Thank you for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off, celebrating 11 years of legal commentary excellence. Alec Murda's murder convictions in South Carolina were tossed, so what's next? Anna Kaminsky is a professor of law at New York Law School and director of Criminal Defense Clinic and managing attorney at New York Law School Legal Services, Inc. Professors, thanks so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you for having me.
We all follow this story, obviously, one of the most watched trials in the last few years. He was convicted, Murda was convicted of murdering his wife and son. But now, recently, the South Carolina Supreme Court threw out the conviction over what it called shocking jury interference by the court clerk, a woman named Becky Hill. Among the things that she did that the court based their decision on was that she told jurors not to be fooled by Murda and to watch his body language closely. How damaging, Professor, is that kind of outside influence to the integrity of a verdict? Obviously very damaging per the court, right?
Yes. I mean, we view the jury and jury deliberations and their job as sort of the holy of holies, right? We are not to interfere with that in any way. When I say we, I'm talking about anyone who is not a part of those 12 individuals. So we look at any interference as really intrinsically harmful to the process.
Right. I mean, the idea is that a jury should base their decision on the evidence presented, not these opinions, particularly from someone as involved in the trial as a court clerk. Right. And we heard some testimony from some of the jurors that they were at least influenced by that. Right. So why is it particularly damaging, at the risk of making an obvious question, for someone who's involved with the court system to do these things?
Right. Well, you can imagine that, you know, for someone in her position, she's going to be influential, right? It's not even just an outside person who says, hey, you know, I think he might have done it. But rather, you're talking about someone who's involved in the process, who's respected by the jurors, right? They're part of the court. They're affiliated with the judge, who garners a lot of respect. And so when you have someone like that getting involved with the jurors' process, with their deliberations, that's where we see, prejudice. In particular.
Okay, so the prosecutors have said they will appeal, and which will mean a whole new trial, right? And that brings a lot of interesting legal questions, because this was a very highly publicized trial. It took a long time, lots of resources, lots of money, and they've got to go do it all over again. So how does that favor the defendant? I mean, the conventional wisdom is that a new trial generally favors the defendant. Do you agree with that? And if so, why?
I absolutely agree with that. And the reason is because the defense has seen the case. And, you know, sometimes prosecutors will say, well, they've seen the case because we've given them all the evidence, right? Before the trial starts, we've given them the evidence. But the defense has not seen how witnesses testify, how they come off on the stand, how the cross-examination goes, what lands or doesn't land in their openings and closings. And so they've now done all that. And with this retrial, they're able to look at what worked, what didn't work, and make an assessment and start over.
Why does that not favor the prosecutors as much? I mean, certainly they are also seeing the defendant's case, but it favors the defense more. Explain why it's not an equal split.
Right. Well, so the prosecutor knows ahead of time, right? They've dealt with their witnesses. They've prepped their witnesses. And yes, of course, they haven't seen the cross-examination, but they've, you know, thought through what might be the cross-examination. What are the pitfalls with respect to their witnesses? What are the weaknesses? So, of course, there is some benefit to the prosecutors in terms of a retrial with respect to the approach. But of course, it's a big drawback because they got a conviction the first time. They wanted that conviction to stand and it didn't. With respect to the defense, I can't emphasize enough the value of being able to see the prosecutor's case start to finish and then getting to look at it and say, okay, how do I want to do this differently as the defense attorney?
That's an important reminder to our listeners and viewers of the concept that we've frequently covered on Legal Face-Off, which is burden of proof, right? The prosecutors, the state in this case, has the burden to prove the elements of their case. Defense has no burden whatsoever. They could stop, as we've seen in many trials, you know, they could stop at the rest of the case in chief and say, we've got nothing else, and win the case because they don't have any burden. And when you have a retrial, the defense gets to even more foresee whether they have met that burden and also, you know, present anything they want or not present anything to, in contradiction of that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, technically speaking, the defense, they don't have to do an opening statement. They don't have to cross-examine anyone. Those are all choices that the defense makes, right? It's rare for a defense attorney not to stand up and make an opening statement. But that burden always lies on the prosecution, on the state. And so, therefore, the defense doesn't have to do anything.
Well, another thing that I think was an issue in throwing out the conviction was the reliance on financial crimes that Murdaugh is in fact serving time on right now. And even if he is found innocent on the second murder charge, will spend basically the rest of his life in jail for the, you know, for the fraud. But prosecutors have signaled that they will spend less time on that and more narrowly on the murder itself and the evidence supporting the murder. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a smart decision. And the reason it's smart is because the court, the appellate court, in its decision said that they thought that the prosecution was allowed to present too much evidence with respect to the financial crimes. And one of the things that we're concerned with is, you know, whether or not the jurors are making a decision about the evidence that's in front of them with respect to this particular crime, or whether they're looking at the defendant and any prior crimes or bad acts and saying, well, because he committed a crime or committed a bad act before, he's more likely to do it here. And so the court really cautioned the prosecutor and the court, whomever the judge is that does this trial, to really think thoughtfully about what outside evidence, in particular with respect to these other crimes, is allowed in front of the jury so that it doesn't influence them improperly.
But maybe the judge, they were throwing a bone to the state, right, saying that you have to go through another trial, but here's a pathway to be not maybe be successful, but avoid this thing, because you're right. You know, the evidence has to be more probative than prejudicial is the test. And you don't want a jury to focus on someone being a bad person. But in this case, the logic was that the murder was motivated by, you know, the financial distress he was in. That's why he was let in. But yeah, I think that the prosecutors, I agree with you, would be wise to avoid that and focus on what seems to be pretty substantial evidence on the murder itself. Let's turn to DNA, because the defense is also talking about, or at least hinting, that there's new DNA evidence and alternate suspect theories that were not really put forth, at least front and center, before the jury in the first trial. What do you think that'll look like in the second trial?
Well, this really dovetails with what we started out talking about, which is the advantage of the defense already seeing the prosecutor's case, right? So now they get to look at it and say, what worked, what didn't work with respect to the prosecutor's case, but also with respect to the defense that we put forward, what worked and what didn't work, and should we be approaching this differently? So whether this is, in fact, you know, new evidence that they have that they want to present, or whether this is evidence that they had but decided not to put in front of the jury at the time and now think might be better or more beneficial, is all a calculation. And again, having had the opportunity to see the prosecutor's case start to finish and to see their, you know, they put on a case, to see their case start to finish, really is helpful. And they're going to have a sort of second bite at the apple, so to speak, to see whether they can get an acquittal.
And there's no limit, Professor, as to what they can introduce at the second trial. It's not like they had to offer evidence at the first trial and then they're limited by that, correct? I mean, they could offer anything that meets the, you know, material and relative tests that any evidence is held to, correct?
Right. So generally speaking, the defense is going to be permitted to put forward whatever defense they decide. Obviously, the court may make some particular evidentiary rulings. And what I will say is it certainly gets slightly complicated in terms of, you know, whether the defendant chooses to testify again, and then whether his prior testimony could be used to impeach him or used in whole or in part in any way with respect to the prosecutor's case. That gets quite complicated, and the judge will make some rulings about that. But overall, yes. Right. The defense is allowed to present the evidence that they want to present as long as it's permissible evidence.
We're almost out of time. We really appreciate it. But we often talk in these high profile cases, and the most high profile case in history was probably the OJ case, where they moved, you know, venues because of jury prejudice. In this case, I think there's a high chance that the defense will move to change venue because, you know, this was a conviction, a very high profile conviction in this jury pool. So do you think they'll do that? And do you think that'll be granted? And talk to us a little bit about what the dangers are of maybe trying it before the same jury pool.
Sure. So it won't be the same jury pool, but certainly you're right with respect to geographically, it may be the same. And I think at the end of the day, the question will be for the court, you know, can we find fair and impartial jurors with respect to this particular area that we're going to be pulling jurors from? And to your point, this is highly publicized. It's clearly something that affected many, many people, both, you know, locally and nationally. And so it won't be a matter of, has this person ever heard about the case before? But rather, with respect to anything that they know or any sort of preconceived notions that they may have, are they able to set those aside and be fair and impartial and only make a decision with respect to what's presented in front of them? And of course, yes, I would expect the defense may very well raise a change of venue motion. And, you know, we don't really know yet what the court will make of that, depending upon what they have in that motion.
All right, last question we have for, we really appreciate it, is, you know, a lot of our listeners and viewers hear a second trial, they think of this concept of double jeopardy. Why does trying Murdaugh again not violate constitutional protections against double jeopardy?
So the simplest way to think about it is this. First, he wasn't acquitted. So if he was acquitted, done. The prosecutor does not get to try the case twice. Secondly, he appealed. So if you think about it, double jeopardy, generally speaking, is something that inures to the benefit of the defendant. And so here what he did was he asked for a new trial. He said, don't let this conviction stand. And because the new trial is not based on a lack of evidence, but rather on this jury interference, there will be a new trial, and we don't have any double jeopardy issues.
More on this to come. Stay tuned. Professor Anna Kaminsky, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you.
You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at Deckard LLP and global co-chair of the firm's intellectual property practice. She has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers and Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. For more than 150 years, Deckard has advised the innovators who move industries forward. From the railroad pioneers of the 19th century to the world's top asset managers today, Deckard helps leaders uncover opportunity and unlock advantage. If you would like to learn more about Christina Martini and Deckard, visit Deckard.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. On today's edition, we bring in Pat Millhiser, a writer, storyteller, problem solver, and relationship builder. Oh, and he runs Millhiser Public Relations. Pat worked communications for the Cook County Circuit Court. He spent 15 years with the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin and Chicago Lawyer Magazine. Pat, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ryan. Good to be here.
All right, in this corner, Jacqueline Newman, an accomplished commercial litigator and trial lawyer. She's secured eight-figure jury verdicts. She's been a lead attorney on many complex arbitrations, bench trials, and jury trials with Harris St. Laurent in New York. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. Happy to be here.
All right, we start Legal Grab Bag with, wait, Biden Watch? What is this, Rich? This can't be right. We usually start talking about the president, not the former president, but the former president is suing the Justice Department to block release of interview audio. He says it's tied to classified files. All right, Rich, this isn't what I figured you'd be starting with, but go ahead and get us kicked off here.
I mean, we're kicking it back to, 2022, maybe. But no, we actually have a Trump watch. You know, the late-breaking story today, we didn't throw it in. But, I mean, I don't know if you guys heard about this investigation into E. Jean Carroll that the DOJ has started. E. Jean Carroll, of course, you know, won two separate civil lawsuits against Trump, one for defamation and sexual abuse. And now, like many of Trump's enemies, the DOJ, which is now Trump's personal, you know, attack dog, is actually investigating her. She's 82, 83, whatever she is. Again, she convinced 24 separate people that Trump was guilty and is a victim of sexual abuse. And now she is being investigated. So more of the nonsense that Trump is doing. But we'll jump into the Biden story because the DOJ is looking to release transcripts. So it's kind of a Trump story because his DOJ continues their record of nonsense and corruption by, Tina, looking to release transcripts and audio of interviews that were done that really had a lot of effect on the 2024 campaign. You remember that it was discovered that he didn't know when his son's birthday was, according to these transcripts, and, you know, had some other memory issues. And the term that her, who was the special prosecutor named in this case, used was that that Biden, you know, didn't do anything illegal with his possession of these confidential documents. But he said that he was a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory, underlining the whole attack of Biden that he was, you know, just basically out to lunch, which ironically is being supported today by his wife, who in her new book says that she worried that he had a stroke during that fateful debate. But anyway, Biden sued, looking to prevent the release of these transcripts, saying that they're privileged, that they shouldn't be released. And of course, Trump came out yesterday and said, you know, they should be released, and this is evidence of corruption. But I don't know. Haven't we had enough with Biden? Isn't this story kind of old? But the DOJ continues through Trump to raise these old issues, because Trump has continued to be pissed off about these old stories.
Yeah, I you know, I have a fundamental problem with these transcripts being used for a purpose that is not what they were intended for. That being said, I'm not really sure that conversations he had with the person who ended up writing a book about him is necessarily confidential. But I agree with you that this is, you know, when we zoom out on this story, it's just more of the same. And it's like, why are we retreading on this story? I mean, Biden is dealing with his health challenges. He is off in the sunset, not really sure why we're going down this path again. But, you know, obviously there's other things going on in the world right now. So there's, you know, deflection, distraction, whatever you want to call it, going on here.
Yeah, I mean, it's ironic, well stated, but it's ironic, Pat, that an administration that had to have legislation put forward to release the Epstein files and violated that law, that actual constitutional law, and then, you know, primaried the guy who was the lead sponsor of that, now is in favor of transparency. Let's release these transcripts that were conducted during a criminal investigation because it's relevant. How is it relevant? I mean, you know, just meant to embarrass the former president. Haven't we had enough of this? I don't know. Maybe you have a different thought.
No, we have. I take both of what you and Tina said. You know, if we could take the period 2016 to 2024, that's an 8-year period where we've, you know, never seen anything like the things that have come up in that time, and it's continuing into this presidency. And I think we need to put the past in the past. I don't know what what the point of this is. I understand what former President Biden is doing legally to block it, and I think we'll get some interesting case law out of this for sure. But I don't think this entire saga is resonating with Americans who are more worried about everything else, the cost of everything, the rise of AI, you know, the loss of privacy and a war. And it just all makes you wonder, what is the political strategy other than to keep bringing up the past to justify whatever tactics are coming in the November election regarding voting and election results and things like that? This strikes me as something to get people all, get the base, the extreme base, whipped up about something.
Right. And again, I mean, it's like, you know, you can't make this stuff up. Remember that this was an investigation about Biden failing to return classified documents to the National Archives. Trump did the same thing and refused to even turn them over like Biden eventually did.
For sure. And that's a long running theme of the last couple of years. You know, you're against it when it hurts you, and you're for it when you think it might help you. And that's been going on and on, I'd say, since, 2016, basically.
Jacqueline, what are your thoughts?
I agree in the sense that it's irrelevant, and it's not relevant to anything going on in the world right now, and there were more important things going on, and Trump is being hypocritical. However, to play devil's advocate, I do think the biggest question is, we already have the written transcript, which provides all the facts. Why do you now need the audio of that to to prove any other facts. But I do think the audio is very compelling compared to a written transcript, and putting politics to the side and just like looking at this very objectively, right? Like that's why we have live witness testimony at trial. And that's why we don't submit written transcripts to a jury. And that's why we present live testimony to assess credibility, you know, when someone stutters or looks around. So I do think there is inherent value in listening to the audio. That said, I think that cuts both ways. I think that does support Biden's argument, right? You have Republicans saying, well, why do you need to release the audio when you already have this written transcript? Or no, the Republicans are saying, you know, what's the harm in submitting the audio? But I think the harm is that it does add a layer of complexity that could really harm Biden to go to something that's totally irrelevant in the current state of play. So I do agree, but I do think the audio is important and different than just a written transcript, which I think can go to both sides' arguments.
Let's move along then to the next thing. A Florida biologist was fired for a social media post on Charlie Kirk's assassination, and just one big in court.
Yeah, this is one of many lawsuits that were brought by people who were fired after they made comments following the Charlie Kirk shooting. Most of the comments were not very flattering to Kirk, I would say. And they were fired because their employer thought that their comments were inappropriate. Okay, so Tina, the class of people who were fired fall into one of two categories, either state employees or state or federal employees, government employees, or private employees. And the reason that the cases have been resulting in settlements in favor of these employees is because they were government employees, and they argued successfully, either generally through settlements so far, that their First Amendment rights were violated when they were fired for making comments. Remember, you know, the First Amendment says that the government, says Congress, shall make no law, right? That means that you can exercise your freedom of speech, but your employer also has the right to act upon that. If they are a private employer, like a law firm or a convenience store, and your employer doesn't like what you said because they think it's offensive, they can fire you, and you have very little redress against a private employer. Now, if they fire you in contradiction of a contract or some kind of union agreement or because of other reasons like your race or age, then you have a cause of action. As opposed to whether if you work for a public employer like the federal government or like the state government in this case, then you have an argument that your First Amendment rights are being violated because you're fired by the government. And that's what happened here. So we're seeing a lot of these cases where people brought these lawsuits and they're getting, you know, pretty substantial amounts. In this case, $485,000as damages for lost wages, assorted, you know, other damages like pain and suffering, et cetera. So we'll see this continue, I think. And, you know, they seem to be pretty logical arguments, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you fall down on this issue.
Yeah. No, I think that you teed this up really well. I think what's interesting is I'm not sure if this is indicative of a pendulum swing here. I mean, you did mention, rightly so, that a big distinguishing factor here is that these are government employees rather than private employees. But that being said, I just have to wonder if there would have been an effort, and if there was an effort to try to argue that these folks were terminated for other things that would not have fallen within the free speech sort of rubric. So I don't know. I mean, I find it interesting. I think it's the right result. It's just, it's going to be interesting to see how these continue to play out.
Yeah. Jacqueline, what are your thoughts? I mean, do you think this chills free speech, encourages free speech? I guess you could look at it either way in many cases.
Well, I think because they settled, you don't really know what the ultimate result would have been. But I do think this was a case of government overreach, where mostly because there was no real evidence that the speech materially impacted the government's operations, right? There were only like 50 complaints, even though they claimed there were like hundreds of complaints. So given that she was acting purely, it seemed, in her private capacity, right? She was using her private Instagram, not within the scope of her science duties. You know, it's not like she was a police officer talking about racist things. It was completely outside the scope of her duties. It's just that she happens to also be an employee of the government. And I think if there was a more drastic impact on the operations, I think that they would have had a stronger claim. But I do think in this case, it was a little bit of viewpoint discrimination or maybe fear that something would happen more drastically if they didn't take action versus actually, you know, reacting to a material impact. So I think she was acting in her private capacity and, you know, they were overreaching here and trying to, you know, restrict free speech.
In your former life, you use the First Amendment every damn day. You were in the media. What's your perspective on this story?
Yeah, well, I think obviously there was exposure here or this wouldn't have settled. And it settled for a pretty good amount. So obviously there was a feeling that there was a case here. But and I am, of course, a defender of the First Amendment. But where I land on this, regardless of whether it's a public or private employer, you know, every American has the right to say whatever you want to say. But there are consequences for your words, actions, and habits. There are no consequences for your thoughts. Your thoughts are your own. But once those manifest themselves, there are and should be consequences. You know, to me, it's an issue of you take statements on a case-by-case basis to determine if someone should be fired for their statements. But I absolutely believe people should and can be fired for them. You can say them, but there's a risk. And it just, you know, but obviously this was, they looked at this and decided we have exposure here. So it's settled.
All right, let's move along to the next one. A tourist was seen on tape throwing a rock at a rare Hawaiian seal. He was in court this week. He actually pleaded not guilty. He's caught on tape. But his attorney says that he was actually brutally assaulted.
Yeah, Ryan.
Not by the seal, though, right? Not by the seal.
No.
Not by the seal. No, by somebody else who didn't like what he did. So, yes, this is a tourist. His name is Igor Litvinchuk.
You're much braver than me. I wasn't even going to try to say the name. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of consonants, but I think
it's
got
Russian
it.
For seal hater.
This is actually a very disturbing story to me as an animal and creature lover, but, so he is at the beach and he decides that he's going to throw this humongous rock at the Hawaiian monk seal, which is an endangered animal. And people saw it, and apparently his defense is that he had mistaken the monk seal for an aggressive sea lion, which I'm sorry, you shouldn't be throwing rocks at anything, whether they're sea lions or monk seals. But in any event, he claims he was trying to get this aggressive sea lion that he thought it was away from the turtles. And there's been video that's surfaced since this time, and apparently he's gotten some severe backlash. He's gotten death threats, and actually somebody allegedly brutally assaulted him once they figured out that he was the guy who was in the video assaulting the Hawaiian monk seal. So in any event, I chalk this up, Rich, to, you know, the plethora of stories that we cover on the show of people doing really indescribably cruel things and trying to justify their actions. I mean, I just don't understand why he felt the need to throw anything at anything.
Yeah, I mean, this guy's, you know, we're speaking of poop later, but this guy's full of crap. This guy's so full of crap. I mean, the incident report says that he said he was rich enough to pay fines and did not care. And, you know, it's classic, like, post-arrest bullshit. I think the remedy, I mean, yeah, now he's facing backlash. Like, you know, wham, wham, wham. You know, the backlash he should face is he should be treated the way he treated the seal. Let's line this guy up in an environment where he's not comfortable, protected, and throw rocks at him and see how he likes it, right? I mean, this is
stonings are new to Legal Face-Off. We have not discussed public stonings.
I feel like we're back in the 1500s.
let's do it, man. I mean, you know, not only is it a violation of the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act, it's just so disgusting and cruel, to your point. You know, we all love animals, and, you know, this is a defenseless beast, and he should face the maximum fine and then some. But Pat, you hate animals. Please take the opposite. Someone defend the guy.
Well, he did get his street justice, right? That there already happened. So that happened almost immediately. Following up with what Tina said, you know, he is taking an interesting defense that, you know, we'll see how it plays. Essentially an animal defense. I don't think humans are allowed to interfere in nature. That seems like a new one to me, and we'll see how that plays out when he gets his day in court.
But I love the fact, Jacqueline, that this guy is seemingly shocked that he's been I mean, does he not think that there are cameras? Is he not aware of these videos that are all over the place of people throwing rocks in national parks and, you know, doing stuff to animals? I mean, doesn't he think, what does he think is going to happen?
Yeah, I totally agree. Especially his comments were like, I'm rich, find me. It just shows how ignorant he is. And, you know, it's not like he's a 15-year-old boy in North Korea and doesn't really know what, you know, the rules are, whatever that case was. He's a grown man, I believe, and he knows how these things look. And it just seems like he just thought he can get away with it. And Tina, to your point, I don't understand why he's throwing rocks at anything, even if one animal is not endangered and the other is. So I totally agree. And trying to give him the, you know, play the opposite argument, if there is one, I guess the best argument from his perspective is there was no actual injury. So what are we talking about here? It's just the action. But, you know, I think given all the other facts here, that's a pretty weak argument. I do think this is a good example of kind of how trials happen even before you get to the courtroom, right? It's like the whole country is looking at this on the news and basically have already judged him, and no one's going to care what the elements of the statute are. So I think that's just a really good example of how you just really need to pay attention to what's going on out there, because ultimately public perception is more important than, you know, the legal elements in this case.
By the way, we were going to include another animal story. Did you see that idiot who jumped into the cage of what's his name? That monkey. What's that monkey's name? Punch.
Punch.
Yeah, the guy jumped into the Punch enclosure and got arrested dressed as a big, you know, monkey.
Yeah.
Did not see that. Oh my God.
Or Punch.
All right. I want to see a show of hands. If Britney Spears invited you over for dinner, would you go? Who's going? Come on, Pat.
Hell yes.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, right. Just to watch the show.
I'd bring the knives, too.
All right. Now, would you go if you were the cop who was arrested for her DUI?
Well, would you go, and would you think that she'd be making lasagna? Because, I mean, hopefully not, I guess, the end of the Britney Spears stories on Legal Face-Up. But it's one of those stories that keeps giving. So we know that she was arrested for DUI again a few weeks ago. We have seen some of the video. Now we've seen even more of the body cam video in which she approaches the officers and she says, among other things, she says, I apologize. She says she was on her phone. She says that you can come to my house. I'll make you food or lasagna or whatever you want. So food, I take that literally. Food, number one. Number two, lasagna. Or anything you want. I don't know what that includes, but that leaves a lot to the imagination. Then she offers that she has a pool, you know, maybe a little pool party with the coppers, Tina. She also says that on a scale of 0 to 10, her inebriation is 0. So, not consistent with what we later know. She was sentenced to 12 months of probation. She was ordered to attend the DUI education program. We've seen lots of examples of people trying to sway police. Offering lasagna is a first, but who knows? I mean, everyone loves a good lasagna.
Last time I checked, trying to bribe a police officer isn't really the way to try to get out of trouble.
Right.
And if you're going to do it with something that matters. I'm sorry.
Lasagna matters. Ask Garfield the cat.
She offered whatever they want.
I like a good lasagna just like everybody else. But, you know, I'm sorry. if you're going to actually cross the line of bribing a police officer, like, do it with something that really matters and not lasagna.
I mean, she said whatever you want. I would say, I would respond, yeah, I want you to recreate the I'm a slave for you video with the boa and everything. I would say, okay, let's go. Let's do this. Jacqueline, Pat, any sympathy for, I mean, you know, I feel bad,
yes.
I guess, but
oh, yes.
maybe take control of your lookout.
Yeah, I'd give somebody grace in this situation. I do some work in the spaces of addiction recovery and treatment. And this is, you know, we've been seeing these stories for years now for somebody who was, you know, she took the pop culture world by storm in late 90s through the mid 2000s. And here we are 20 years later. You know, this is obviously something that, you know, I don't know what the solution is at this point, but I would give her a little grace in the situation and try, you know, I don't know what kind of support she has, but there's not enough of a support system around her to prevent this. You know, same with when you have the example of Tiger Woods driving, like, why are you driving at this point? You know, let's take that out of the equation, and then we can start looking at some of the other issues going on.
I'll tell you who really also should be given grace, frankly, is me and Lisa for trying to come up with a different variation of a punny title for a Britney Spears DUI story. We've run the gamut. We came up with this one, Hit Me Baby One More Wine. But yeah, you know, we're running out of funny ways to talk about the story. But Jacqueline, any thoughts on this one?
Well, I think it's interesting because they basically used the bribe against her. She was under the legal limit, and they used this of, you know, evidence of eccentric behavior that she wouldn't have exhibited if she was sober. So I didn't actually realize this, but even if you're under the legal limit, based on your behavior and your driving, they can still say that, you know, you were under the influence if it just seems like you're drunk. So that statement actually completely worked against her in this case. And I do agree, Pat, with, you know, out taking the driving away from all of it. It's just like these celebrities are in the public eye, and we've all done, you know, bad things in our lives, and they're always, you know, on camera for everything. So I do think giving her some grace here, you know, would be nice.
And Pat, you are our lone holdout for lasagna with Britney. Would you do, since you brought him up, would you do lasagna with Tiger Woods?
Probably. Yeah.
There you go.
I think right. I have to hear how the offer is made in order to decide if I'm accepting. This is something where I need the audio. Like okay. Jacqueline was saying earlier, she wants the audio provides nuance. The audio definitely provides nuance if you're getting this lasagna invitation.
And we do joke about this, and Rich brought it up. You know, unfortunately, her name has popped up. We don't want to see this go down the path of Anna Nicole Smith. That's been another one that we kind of saw this, you know, continued issues with. We've seen Kanye West continue to have these kind of issues. So we're rooting for Britney. We don't mean to joke about it if she is battling something, but it is an interesting story, Britney Spears and lasagna. All right. A battle of two big brands, Columbia Sportswear and Columbia University. The outdoor clothing company is suing the New York College over trademark infringement. Tina, should the Chicago Liberal Arts School, the capital of South Carolina, and the South American nation also be concerned?
Well, the South American nation is not spelled the same way, but, you know, we won't get, you know, too granular on that. So thanks for the tee up, Ryan. So this is an interesting case. How this came into the grab bag is that Columbia University, who, as Ryan mentioned, is being sued by Columbia Sportswear, had filed a motion to dismiss this trademark infringement lawsuit. And that motion to dismiss was denied. Columbia University also tried to move the case from Oregon, which is where Columbia Sportswear is based, to New York, which obviously is where Columbia is. You know, what's interesting here, without getting too much into the procedural weeds, the judge found that there are issues that need to be vetted and allowed the case to continue. And also said that, frankly, there was enough of a connection between what Columbia University is alleged to be doing here, which is infringing the trademark on the apparel. And so they said there was enough of a connection to Oregon for the case to continue to proceed in Oregon, because presumably Columbia University had sold some clothes there. So this all started last July. The parties have an agreement going back to June of 2023. Columbia University was trying to register its brand in connection with apparel, had issues with the Columbia sportswear mark. They decided to work out an agreement where Columbia University would be allowed to register its name and use it on apparel as long as the name was used with other indicia of the university. For example, a shield, a crown symbol, lion mascot. There has to be something beyond just the word Columbia on apparel. Allegedly, the university did sell some apparel that had only the word Columbia on it without these other indicia. And for that reason, Columbia Sportswear has sued. What's interesting is that Columbia University is arguing that they've been along since long before Columbia Sportswear. What's interesting here, Rich, in addition to what I just teed up, is yes, Columbia University been around for a long time, but not necessarily merchandising, which is where there's this intersection with Columbia Sportswear. There hasn't really necessarily been this intersection from the apparel side of things, which is how this whole thing came about.
I mean, it's definitely a closer case than some of the dumb lawsuits we've covered in this area, but it's still dumb. I mean, it'd be one thing if they were only focusing on Oregon, right? I mean, maybe, but this is across the country. And how many people are really confused by Columbia Sportswear, which is a pretty well-known brand with a distinct logo that is visually, logically, nothing like, aesthetically, nothing like, you know, Columbia University. I mean, you know, I'm sure you could find if we thought about other similar entities, schools or institutions that share their name with other brands, that you could find them. But yeah, I don't know. This just seems like a stupid money grab. And even without the shield or without the, you know, I don't think anyone's really confusing the two just because the name is on apparel. But anyone did Pat? Thoughts? Yeah. I mean, it is a bit of a closer case than some of the others, but I still think it's junk.
Legally, I'm sure there's a case. In the court of common sense, nobody, no students, alums, or fans of Columbia University are buying school gear because it looks like the Columbia brand. And is the brand saying that there are people who online are seeking our stuff, but they're accidentally buying from the Columbia bookstore? I don't know. It does not pass the court of common sense. They're two completely different things.
But there's an agreement between the parties, guys. So let's not forget that.
Right. Yeah. So clearly it was contemplated, right? But Jacqueline, you work in the space. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so this was my favorite one. I was going back and forth on this for a while. I feel like I keep flipping sides. But it's interesting because, Rich, you mentioned, you know, no one's going to confuse the university with the sports apparel brand. So I guess it really depends how the word Columbia is placed on the, right? If you have that really big university sweatshirt, even if it doesn't have the logo, but it's just like huge Columbia letters, you're like, okay, I know that's the university. We all know Columbia University. But if it's more minimalist and it's like a zip up with just Columbia in small letters, that's more indicative of, oh, maybe this could be the apparel company because it's not like a typical university, you know, sweatshirt in that sense. And Pat, you raised a good point where, you know, people that are seeking the Columbia University stuff are not necessarily going to think they're getting the right. They're going to go to the online bookstore and things like that. But I think with Amazon and downstream marketing, you could get into a situation where you might think you're getting a Columbia University sweatshirt, but maybe it's the Columbia. But then I don't know, Rich, you noted the logo, which is another thing with the sports apparel company. It's like, it's always going to have that logo typically. But yeah, I do.
What about the basic idea that Columbia has been around for, since, what was the year, 17 something, right? And if you're starting a company after that date, even a year after 1754, and you decide to start a company that also is the same name as this other institution, that's on you. That's not on anyone else. That's on you.
They're different products.
Like one of them different. That would not be an infringement, Rich. I don't want Jacqueline and I to get too trademark nerdy, but that would not be an infringement.
Yeah, and I think that's where, like, because the apparel company is the one selling the apparel. So when you have the university now, it's making apparel. You're actually infringing, or arguably infringing, on the apparel company now. So it is an interesting, very close case with good arguments on both sides.
No, but you're overcomplicating it. The apparel company is the one who came after the university. They're saying that we're wrong. You're not wrong if you decided to take the name of another company. That's caveat emptor. I mean, you took that risk
That's
knowing this other company
law,
was around.
That's not the trademark law, Rich. Sorry.
I don't
so
know.
They're different. Yeah.
This makes it any murkier, but Columbia Sportswear does sell NCAA gear as well. Licensed NCAA gear, LSU, Oklahoma, Michigan, I'm seeing on here, Texas A&M. So I don't know if that muddies the waters at all that, you know, they do sell NCAA branded gear.
And what about the agreement, right? I think, Tina, you started to mention this, but they've clearly contemplated there would be confusion, which is why they said we'll only have this word with the logo next to it on our apparel.
Right. And if you breach that agreement, it's like, you know, heaven help you. I mean, I think it's actually, this is a case of reverse confusion is what we call it in trademark land, and also a breach of contract. So, you know.
Yeah. And it's just an admission that it is confusing.
Good grief. Snoopy is getting sued over copyright infringement. Tina, 5 cents for your thoughts.
Whatever you do, don't play the music here. Do not.
I was going to say, oh my God, I would love, I mean, this is the time for us to play the music. But so in any event, the owner of certain IP owned by Peanuts is Lee Mendelson Film Productions. They've sued Game Mill, accusing them of copyright infringement. In this puzzle adventure game called Snoopy and the Great Mystery Club that has a score or a soundtrack, if you will. Interestingly, there were some IP that was licensed as Game Mill was contemplating releasing this game. But what they didn't do was they didn't get a license to the music, which when you do a side-by-side of some of the most iconic music that we all grew up with that was made by the very famous Vince Guaraldi trio. When you do a side-by-side, it sounds completely like derivative works. And it's actually like you listen to it and you think this is supposed to be a more contemporary version or a spin-off of the basic music that was in the Charlie Brown shows, including A Charlie Brown Christmas. So a lawsuit's been filed. They're claiming copyright infringement. They're saying they're identical note events and specific rhythmic and metric instantiation overlaps. So I think we should play the music if we can cue it up, but I don't know if we're able to.
No, really? Aren't we going to open ourselves up to some exposure? Let's not, maybe. Let's have
reporting. This is news reporting.
Fair use. Let's have an artistic interpretation of it. Someone sing the
There we go. And I want to point out too that I think you know, if you're looking in the boxes and watching online, if you're listening audio, we've got I would say I'm probably Schroeder. We've got Pat as Linus. We've got Sally as Tina. We've got Lucy as Jacqueline and Rich.
Oh my
who are
God!
You?
Don't say it.
Oh my God!
I mean, it's pretty obvious looking at this angle.
I have no idea who Rich is.
At least I'm not Pigpen. At least you didn't call me Pigpen. But isn't this, again, just an example? We talked about this with Dua Lipa last time, right? Where Dua Lipa was suing because the TV company was using her image. There was an agreement, but apparently not for that. There's an agreement here for, you know, the IP, but not the song. It's very simple. If you wanted the song, you should have paid for it, right? Isn't that all we're talking about here? A contract
case? I think this is pretty clearly a derivative work of the original music.
Yeah.
And under the copyright law, when you are an owner of the copyright in a particular work, you have the rights in the derivative works of a particular work. I mean, the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do is like throughout all the music that these guys did. I mean, it's very clear that it is the Charlie Brown theme.
Yeah.
All right.
Like coupling it with
anyone?
With, I think when it's coupled with the video game as well, that pretty clearly shows intent, right? It's not like it was just another musician creating this song that sounds like this nostalgic tune and, oh, we didn't use the same melody and blah, 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 blah. But here it's like, well, we did this specifically to enhance this video game And it's not like, you know, to say that we didn't know what we were doing or we didn't intend to copy this music is just complete BS. So I agree. And they knew they had to copy to get the rights to the characters. Mm-hmm. And they just, I think, thought they could just get away with not getting the rights to the music. So I agree. And I think there's pretty clear intent here for willful infringement as well.
Pat, any thoughts?
Who's playing the Snoopy video game? That's what I want to know.
I'm a big seller.
If you want to be Schroeder, by the way, you can be Schroeder. I was just looking for someone. I mean, you don't have to be Linus. Yeah, I don't know if you've got... I'm sorry if I threw you off there. I know you don't have a blanket next to you.
Yeah, you gave me the blanket. That's the first thing I thought.
You don't want to be Pigpen.
No.
No one wants to be Pigpen. No. All right.
All right. It's a good question, though. My kid is playing the most violent, dangerous first-person games. He's not messing around with Snoopy and Woodstock.
All right. So the show notes for this last story are, you can't make this bleep up. And after reading through the article, I don't even know what we're bleeping here. Rich, take on this story for us.
Well, the words were SH blank blank. So, yeah, there's a case that was brought by a Queens construction worker that says he was catapulted. All he did is he was catapulted out of a porta potty. I was just spending a lot of time trying to figure out how that exactly works.
Oh, come on. Watch Home Alone, any movie where you've got that kind of humor. Everything gets catapulted.
Yes. So this guy was using the porta potty on a tower in Times Square and said it collapsed as he entered it, and it sent him flying off the curb. Now, interestingly, I thought the story team was going to go to the direction of, you know, he was covered in whatever is in the porta potty. The key to a porta potty visit is like, don't look down, right? Never, ever look down into the black abyss of what's in there. But he's not really alleging damages from that. He's saying that it affected his sex life, that his happiness has been impaired, and his love and companionship with his wife and sexual relations, solace, etc., have been affected. So he's asking for damages. Tina, doesn't say how much, but
there's like no elaboration on what these purported injuries are.
Thankfully.
And believe me, I don't necessarily want them, but I think they're kind of important with the nature of the allegations he's making. And there's also an element from what we can tell from what we've seen. There's also, it appears to be an element that he knew about the danger of using that particular porta potty, and he did it anyway. And in some ways that he used it in a way that created an even greater risk than he would have ordinarily, he undertook a risk, and he made it even riskier.
I wonder what an improper use of a porta potty looks like, what you could be doing that a jury would find you more responsible than who placed it there. I mean, it had to have been a really violent eruption, let's just say, of whatever's happening with this guy's insides. But yeah, I'm not sure. But why don't we conclude by I was going to go in one direction with our final question, guys, but I want to go a different direction since we took a deep dive into lasagna with Brittany story. How about we go around the room and think about, this is a little bit out of left field, it might take you a couple seconds, Ryan Burrow, which I know you love, mm-hmm. but lasagna with Brittany. So we've got a pasta with a 90 star. Besides lasagna with Brittany, if you had to come up with a dream dinner with a pasta and a iconic 90 star, who would it be? Not pasta with Brittany, but Jacqueline, what 90 star would you love to sit down with? What pasta with? Let's go.
90 star. I'm going to have to think back to who was in the 90s. Well, I know young. My pasta would be rigatoni because that's the best pasta out of all the pastas, with vodka sauce and vodka meat sauce.
Okay.
Meatballs.
Got that part down.
90s star. Who are some 90s star? I'm trying to think. This is not, oh.
Were you a fan of?
The band of NSYNC, because that was my favorite band. So rigatoni al vodka with meat sauce with all the NSYNC guys.
Wow. Rigatoni with fettone.
Yeah.
Not bad. Pat, do you now, that we've given you more time than poor Jacqueline, do you have a pasta dish that you would love to share with your favorite star of the 90s? Now, you're a little older than Jacqueline, so you got a deeper pool from which to draw.
Right. I went straight to TV shows, and I went straight to Saved by the Bell and 90210. And I always respected Luke Perry. He was obviously a heartthrob at that time and then went on and did some good stuff after that. But I don't think he ever became the actor that he deserved. I think he, I would love to have a conversation with him about that. He's now passed. And pasta, I like it all. I like a rigatoni with sausage and peas. There's a place in the city of La Gondola that makes it. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's like rigatoni basciola. I don't know if that's a common dish, but that is my favorite pasta. So I'd have that.
Rigatoni. Rigatoni with Perry. All right. Tina was so disgusted with that subject that she jumped right off our damn podcast. But Ryan Burrow, what would be your favorite pasta with a 90s star?
Yeah, I'll go eggplant parmesan with Jennifer Love Hewitt. Well, there was a lot there. That was
I'm trying to get my head around this one.
There's a lot there. Yeah, no, eggplant, I mean, we may delete this later. Yeah,
eggplant parmesan.
I didn't think that out right. I'm a vegetarian, but yeah, there you go. So
wow. So you want to share eggplant? You want to share eggplant with the very voluptuous? Okay, let's just leave that whole one maybe for another time. But Lisa, you love the 90s and pasta.
I would go with the mushroom ravioli.
Mm-hmm.
And then I like Brad Pitt, so I would take Brad Pitt with me.
Like a Legend of the Fall era, 90s
yeah.
Brad Pitt?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any era of Brad Pitt I'd take.
All right, well, I was thinking of a couple. I thought, I like Vanilla Ice, as we all did, and I was thinking vermicelli with Vanilla Ice. Or I was thinking of... Fabio, do you guys remember Fabio?
Yeah.
Star of
Why do you want to sit down with Fabio?
Did you put the spaghetti in his hair? Is that what the flowing spaghetti hair?
I was thinking Fusilli with Fabio, maybe.
Good Lord. All right. Do you have any more for us, Rich? Are you good?
I got lots, but I mean, you just opened up the Party of Five, you know. Party of Five, and I Know What You Did Last Summer, so lots of people there. Maybe like pasta with Freddie Prinze Jr. or some kind of noodle dish with Scott Wolf or Matthew Fox, but yeah, I think we're good.
And by the way, everyone who's on this panel right now is going to be thinking about this for the next several days.
Yes.
And something better is going to pop up in your head. So throw it in the group chat. We'll
I wish I said Rodman.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. All right. Thank you so much, Jacqueline Newman and Pat Millhiser, for joining us. And that'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Professor Anna Kaminsky of New York Law School, Professor Richard Painter, University of Minnesota, shareholder at the firm of Carlton Fields, and former U.S. DOJ counsel Gene Rossi. Also, shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stegall, Fortina Martini, Rich Lenkoff. I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...